Hi, this is Rob Stevens on WDIY, and we're speaking today with Grammy-nominated jazz pianist, composer, and arranger Fred Hirsch. He will be playing with his trio at the superb Williams Center for the Arts at Lafayette College on April 18th. Thanks for joining us today. Will this be your first gig at the Williams Center?
I've been doing a lot of gigs for a lot of years, so sometimes I forget, but I'm pretty sure that I was there maybe in the 6 to 8 year ago range.
Tell us who will be with your trio for this gig.
It's my long-standing band of about 9 years, bassist John Hebert and drummer Eric McPherson. They're just wonderful to play with, and we have, I think, a really special chemistry.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about each of these players. What special qualities that helps the trio reach and shape its sound?
Both of them are very attuned to the sounds that they get out of their instruments, very attuned to dynamics. Rhythmically, we hook up terrifically well. John, he's very adventurous. I mean, he's very capable of just kind of holding down the fort, but he tends to want to nudge the music in lots of different creative directions, which I really enjoy. Eric and John are very interested in looking or playing each tune in a very specific way. So, like, it's not kind of one size fits all. Each piece that we perform has a particular sound palette, or Eric has come up with particular implements that he uses, or an interesting approach to the rhythm. So, I mean, we all are capable of thinking pretty compositionally, and that's what I look for in a band.
So what kind of tunes can we expect to hear at the Williams Center? Originals, classics, solo?
All my concerts are a mix of original material, some things by the great jazz composers, Wayne Shorter, Ornette Coleman. There's always some Thelonious Monk in every concert. And then the occasional cover of something from the American Popular Songbook, or something that we loosely refer to as standards. I think with the trio, it leans a little more heavily on the original material than perhaps a solo concert might.
Your latest trio CD, Sunday Night at the Village Vanguard, it's on Palmetto Records. It ranked number 3 as the Jazz Album of the Year in Downbeat's Critic Poll last year. 5 of the 10 tunes are yours, and the others are a variety of standards and tunes by the Beatles, Kenny Wheeler, Thelonious Monk. How do you choose the tunes to go on the album?
Well, that was just kind of basically what we played on the first set on that particular Sunday night. It was our last night of a 6-night run, and that just sort of happened to be the playlist. The set is more or less in the order it went down. We did import one piece from the second set and got rid of one piece from the first set and replaced it. I really don't plan sets when we go on the stage. Sometimes backstage I'll just look at Eric and John and say, hey guys, what do you want to play first? You know, and just let them choose. Usually once I've gotten a couple of tunes in, then the set begins to take a shape, and then I kind of choose from there. We have quite a large menu of things we could play, but I want to surprise myself. I'd like to surprise the audience and surprise the other guys too.
So you've played often at the Vanguard. You did a solo run a few years back. You do trio runs and probably all kinds of configurations.
Yeah, I play 3 weeks a year there.
3 weeks. What's so special? I mean, that's a legendary jazz club, but what for a player, what's so special about the Vanguard?
Well, it has extraordinary acoustics, not to mention the amazing history of all the 100 and I don't know how many records that have been recorded there. The audience it's very intimate, obviously. There's something about going down the stairs into the basement, seeing all the amazing photographs on the wall of all the greats who have played there. The audience who shows up at the Vanguard are not the kind of people that go to the more touristy jazz clubs in town. There's no food. You know, there's no gift shop. You're pretty much there for, you know, jazz and cocktails. And it's also the best room that I know to be able to play really quietly. I can play one soft chord and it'll fill the club all the way to the back. And this is not because it has a big sound system. It's just something about the special acoustics of that room. You know, it's sort of my home club, and I feel kind of honored every time I play there.
We're going to listen to one of the tunes on the new album, the Beatles tune, For No One. That was Fred Hirsch Trio with the Paul McCartney tune For No One. This is Rob Stevens on WDIY. Fred, are there tunes that are always on your set list? I noticed The Peacocks, which is one of my favorites.
Total coincidence. I mean, it's one of many ballads that we like to play. I've recorded that tune a number of times in different contexts. I always find that it has a special vibe to it. But, no, there's nothing that's ever consistent night to night.
So you're originally from Cincinnati. How do the jazz players and audiences differ in the Midwest from, say, the Northeast?
You know, I started playing jazz in Cincinnati in 1974. So that was before the jazz education boom. That was before the institutionalization of jazz. It all happened in clubs. And also there were local clubs that brought in all the great legends. They would come and play for a week. You could go down and see them for the price of a drink or a small cover charge, get to talk to them at the bar, these great players. And the audiences who followed the local jazz scene were just people who were very passionate about jazz. The gigs didn't pay very much. Nothing was super organized. Kind of people called tunes that you just had to know. It was very much of a underground kind of thing, and I really enjoyed that. I didn't have a jazz piano teacher. I just kind of learned by listening to records, by hanging out in the bandstand with the older musicians, kind of getting my butt kicked from time to time. Just really kind of went about it in my own way. And, you know, now if I was a kid now and interested in improvising, I mean, as a 12-year-old, you can go to summer jazz camp, and you can, you know, it's a very different thing. We have jazz competitions now. None of that stuff was even conceivable in the mid-70s.
Changing the subject a little bit, you recently wrote your autobiography titled Good Things Happen Slowly, A Life in and Out of Jazz. It was published last year. What's the meaning of the title, Fred?
Well, it's a double meaning. I think the phrase really is, you know, it kind of describes my career. I think, you know, I've been at this for a very long time, and I think things seem to be getting better for me every year in terms of the kind of engagements I'm doing, my relationship with the press and the critics, my audience. You know, I'm one who's kind of just stuck to it, and it's been just kind of a slow crescendo. But I was in a coma for 2 months in the summer of 2008, and when I was admitted to the ER with a septic shock, organ failure, and very close to death, I was just wheeled away, and my partner, Scott, was kind of standing there wanting, you know, nobody was really telling him what was going on. They were just trying to save my life. And after a while, somebody, when I was in the ICU for what turned out to be those 2 months, one of the doctors said to him, in the ICU, good things happen slowly, but bad things happen fast. I think a number of people I know, say, have had parents or grandparents that have gone into the ICU, and all of a sudden George is doing better, and then George gets an infection and dies. You know, there's a lot of things that can go wrong when the body is in that kind of state. So there's definitely a double meaning to the title.
It's well written. It's quite revealing and honest. And you discuss your pursuit of the music. You discuss coming out as a gay man in the jazz culture that really wasn't accepting of gays at the time. Your diagnosis with HIV, and as you referred to, your near death from pneumonia. Why write it at this point of the career?
Well, I mean, a lot of things lined up that I had the opportunity to write it and was able to secure through a literary agent a deal with a major publisher. Also, writing something, I'm 62, writing something around my 60th year, it kind of, in Japanese culture, at age 60, you're reborn, you know, you begin your next life. And I felt like I've lived long enough to deserve to write my story, but I can still remember everything, and hopefully I still have many more years in front of me. But I was certainly very honest and didn't hold back in the book. I felt like there's no reason to do that. Of course, when you write something that's 300 pages, you have to decide what to leave in, what to put in, what to take out. You know, how do you communicate effectively to the reader who may or may not even know that much about my music, but might be interested in my story from other angles. So it was a lot of work, but the response has been very gratifying.
And how's your health currently? And does it affect your stamina in performing and touring?
Because no, my health is absolutely great. I mean, better now than it was 15, 20, 25 years ago.
That's great to hear.
Yeah.
So you write in your book about practicing Buddhist meditation. Is that a current practice of yours?
Yes, it is. It's a, when I, you know, it's hard on the road, but I do sit every morning when I can, and later this month I'll be going on a meditation, silent meditation retreat. I try to do one of those every year. Playing music is a very, it's sort of an active meditation, you know, requires concentration and awareness, not just of what you're doing, but what the other people you're playing with are doing, and being receptive, but also not being passive. So there's a lot that I take from music onto the cushion and vice versa.
And how does the taming the monkey mind impact your playing and your composing?
Well, you know, I mean, we're all human, and sometimes I get distracted for whatever reason. I might be distracted, and certainly the mind's job is to think, and sometimes people have a misconception about what it means to meditate. You're not sitting there emptying your mind. What you're doing is you're just being present with whatever comes up, and some days, yes, you have monkey mind, so you just need to observe it and go, okay, this is what's happening. I'm going to try to get focused on my breath, but I may or may not, it's not about, you know, rating your sitting. Oh, that was a really good sitting. You know, it's just, it's a time capsule. It's a half an hour or 40 minutes of just sitting with yourself and seeing what comes up. And sometimes when I'm playing, there can be a little more chatter than other times. And I found that usually there's more chatter when maybe the sound isn't so good or the piano isn't so great. It's very easy to start thinking a little too much. But with experience, you know, I can have a second or two of elapsed concentration, and probably not too many other people would notice it. I can certainly cover it pretty well.
You've been nominated for Grammys 12 times, and most recently in the category of jazz improvisation for your solo record called Open Book. What are the differences of composing and playing in the various settings in jazz, solo, trio, duet, large-scale ensembles?
I mean, there's some things that are similar, but I enjoy them all. I enjoy playing solo, especially in a great hall with a great piano. I've become a bit of a solo piano specialist. I've actually made more solo albums than trio albums. I didn't set out to do that. It's just kind of what happened. So in solo, I'm not obviously interacting with another musician, but I'm interacting with the piano, the acoustics, the particular piece I'm playing, all that. And when I'm playing in a duo, well, first of all, when the other person stops playing, I'm playing solo, so I get to do that too. I love the duo format, just two people back and forth conversation. Sometimes it's not clear who's soloing and who's accompanying. You're just playing stuff together. That's really fun. The trio, you know, I'm a pretty democratic band leader. I don't try to control what goes on too much. You know, with a trio, it's basically two percussionists, piano and drums, and a stringed instrument. So there's a lot of really cool timbral possibilities with the trio, and sometimes I play with a quintet. That's another whole different kind of thing, too. But I really like doing all of it.
As a segue, you and clarinetist Annette Cohen recorded a CD live in Healdsburg. It was a few years back, and it was just released. It's bright. It's very animated recording on which you each have ample room to improvise and play with the melodies. And how does this kind of duo recording differ from others you've done with, like, guitarist Bill Frisell or Lege Lund?
The one that I did with Julian Lage a few years ago, that was live. Annette's record was live. It wasn't intended to be a recording. It was just a concert that was well recorded that we decided to put out. The one with Frisell was done in the studio. There's always a difference between studio recording and live recording. I'm pretty much, at this point, I think out of the last seven albums I've done, six have been live, and three or four of them I have not been aware that they were even being recorded. So that seems to be something that I'm preferring these days. Yeah, I mean, I've done duo albums with vocalists or other clarinetists. Yeah, I really enjoy my duos. Every May, this will be the 11th year, I do a duo week at the Jazz Standard in New York where I have a different guest every night. Some people I've never played with and some people that I've been playing with on an ongoing basis. And that's always really fun to be in a kind of different musical world with a different partner each night.
Another interesting discussion in your book is how you take a tune and make it your own. I think you talk about working on it from the inside. Can you elaborate on this process of spontaneous creation?
Well, that's kind of hard to talk about, honestly. Certainly if I'm playing a tune by Thelonious Monk, I respect what he's written and what he's created, but I don't want to be too swayed by his performance of that piece. So I need to find a way to take what he's written and filter it through my own sensibility and imagination. I think there are many, many tunes that I could sit down and play if you ask me to, but when it really comes to what I might want to put on a recording or play on a big concert, you know, there are certain tunes that I'm more drawn to, and it's just totally idiosyncratic why I'm drawn to them. It's good to know a lot of tunes, but then there are those ones that you really resonate with, and sometimes I've found that certain ballads I'll be really into playing for a while, and then I'll feel like, okay, I need to take a break from them, and then it could be 6, 8, 10 years later, and I'll go, oh, yeah, I haven't played that in a while, and it'll sound fresh again.
So other than Monk, who are your key influences as a jazz pianist?
Oh, God, pretty much everybody. I mean, I can't answer that question. You know, I tell everybody, every pianist except Oscar Peterson, so... That's a pretty wide swath.
Yes, it is. If you could share the stage with any other player, alive or dead, who would that be, Fred?
Sonny Rollins, without question. Okay. I mean, he's not really able to play now, but in my ideal world, he would be my absolute favorite person to play with.
So your book ends with a kind of preface, as I see it, in which you admit you have a great deal to learn, and I suspect you hope to learn something every day. Tell us what you have learned today.
Oh, what I've learned today, it's very interesting. Well, I learned today that I have a potential back problem that I'm going to have to deal with, which I didn't really realize before after seeing my physical therapist. I also learned today that it's been about a year since I've really written any music, so a lot of today I've been thinking about what would be my next kind of composition project. But, you know, every time I sit down at the piano, whether it's a good piano or a bad piano, whatever the scene is, I'd like to think that there's always a possibility or probability that I'm going to play something that I've never played before. And that's not to say that every night will be totally different than any other night. There'll be some things in common, but I would like to think that there's a possibility that something really special could happen. And I have to be just aware and allow that to happen without trying to force it to happen. I have to be cool if it's not happening. And when inspiration happens, I have to be ready to run with it. That just comes from, you know, 40-plus years of doing this.
Fred, I want to thank you for your time and for speaking with me. I'm looking forward to your performance at the Williams Center on April 18th. Tickets for the Fred Hirsch Trio are available and can be ordered online at williamscenter.lafayette.edu or by calling 610-330-5009. And now we're going to leave you with another tune from Fred Hirsch Trio's Sunday Night at the Vanguard CD, his solo piece titled Valentine. This is Rob Stevens on WDIY 88.1. Thanks for listening.